would be expected to close in on him and perhaps not only divest him of his gains, but drive him into bankruptcy. Saunders apparently anticipated this hazard almost as soon as a coroner was in sight, and accordingly made plans to unload some of his stock before winning instead of afterward. His problem was to keep the stock he sold from going right back into the floating supply, thus breaking his corner, and his solution was to sell his $55 shares on the installment plan. In his February advertisements, he stipulated that the public could buy shares only by paying $25 down and the balance in three $10 installments, due June 1st, September 1st, and December 1st. In addition, and vastly more important, he said he would not turn over the stock certificates to the buyers until the final installment had been paid. Since the buyers obviously couldn't sell the certificates until they had them, the stock could not be used to replenish the floating supply. Thus, Saunders had until December 1st to squeeze the short sellers dry. Easy as it may be to see through Saunders' plan by hindsight, his maneuver was then so unorthodox that for a while neither the governors of the stock exchange nor Livermore himself could be quite sure what the man in Memphis was up to. The stock exchange began making formal inquiries, and Livermore began getting skittish. But he went on buying for Saunders' account, and succeeded in pushing Piggly Wiggly's price up well above 70. In Memphis, Saunders sat back comfortably. He temporarily ceased singing the praises of Piggly Wiggly stock in his ads, and devoted them to eulogizing apples, grapefruit, onions, hams, and Lady Baltimore cakes. Early in March, though, he ran another financial ad, repeating his stock offer and inviting any readers who wanted to discuss it with him to drop in at his Memphis office. He also emphasized that quick action was necessary. Time was running out. By now it was apparent that Saunders was trying for a corner, and on Wall Street it was not only the Piggly Wiggly bears who were becoming apprehensive. Finally, Livermore, possibly reflecting that in 1908 he had lost almost $1 million trying to get a corner in cotton, could stand it no longer. He demanded that Saunders come to New York and talk things over. Saunders arrived on the morning of March 12th. As he later described the meeting to reporters, there was a difference of opinion. Livermore, he said, and his tone was that of a man rather set up over having made a piker out of the boy plunger, gave me the impression that he was a little afraid of my financial situation and that he did not care to be involved in any market crash. The upshot of the conference was that Livermore bowed out of the Piggly Wiggly operation, leaving Saunders to run it by himself. Saunders then boarded a train for Chicago to attend to some business there. At Albany, he was handed a telegram from a member of the stock exchange, who was the nearest thing he had to a friend in the white charger and coat of mail set. The telegram informed him that his antics had provoked a great deal of headshaking in the councils of the exchange, and urged him to stop creating a second market by advertising stock for sale at a price so far below the quotation on the exchange. At the next station, Saunders telegraphed back a rather unresponsive reply. If it was a possible corner the exchange was fretting about, he said, he could assure the governors that they could put their fears aside, since he himself was maintaining the floating supply by daily offering stock for loan in any amount desired. But he didn't say how long he would continue to do so. A week later, on Monday, March 19th, Saunders ran a newspaper ad stating that his stock offer was about to be withdrawn. This was the last call. At the time, or so he claimed afterward, he had acquired all but 1,128 of Piggly Wiggly's 200,000 outstanding shares, for a total of 198,872, some of which he owned and the rest of which he controlled, a reference to the installment plan shares whose certificates he still held. Actually, this figure was open to considerable argument. There was one private investor in Providence, for instance, who alone held 1,100 shares. But there is no denying that Saunders had in his hands practically every single share of Piggly Wiggly then available for trading, and that he therefore had his corner. On that same Monday, it is believed, Saunders telephoned Livermore and asked if he would relent long enough to see the Piggly Wiggly project through by calling for delivery of all the shares that were owed Saunders. In other words, would Livermore please spring the trap? "Nothing doing," Livermore is supposed to have replied, evidently considering himself well out of the whole affair. So the following morning, Tuesday, March 20th, Saunders sprang the trap himself. It turned out to be one of Wall Street's wilder days. Piggly Wiggly opened at 75.5, up 5.5 from the previous day's closing price. An hour after the opening, word arrived that Saunders had called for delivery of all his Piggly Wiggly stock. According to the rules of the exchange, stock called for under such circumstances had to be produced by 2:15 the following afternoon. But Piggly Wiggly, as Saunders well knew, simply wasn't to be had, except, of course, from him. To be sure, there were a few shares around that were still held by private investors, and frantic short sellers trying to shake them loose bid their price up and up. But by and large, there wasn't much actual trading in Piggly Wiggly, because there was so little Piggly Wiggly to be traded. The stock exchange post, where it was bought and sold, became the center of a mob scene, as two-thirds of the brokers on the floor clustered around it, a few of them to bid, but most of them just to push, whoop, and otherwise get in on the excitement. Desperate short sellers bought Piggly Wiggly at 90, then at 100, then at 110. Reports of sensational profits made the rounds. The Providence investor, who had picked up his 1,100 shares at 39 in the previous autumn, while the bear raid was in full cry, came to town to be in on the kill, unloaded his holdings at an average price of 105, and then caught an afternoon train back home, taking with him a profit of over $70,000. As it happened, he could have done even better if he had bided his time. By noon, or a little after, the price of Piggly Wiggly had risen to 124, and it seemed destined to zoom straight through the lofty roof above the traders' heads. But 124 was as high as it went, for that figure had barely been recorded when a rumor reached the floor that the governors of the exchange were meeting to consider the suspension of further trading in the stock and the postponement of the short seller's deadline for delivery. The effect of such action would be to give the bears time to beat the bushes for stock, and thus to weaken, if not break, Saunders' corner. On the basis of the rumor alone, Piggly Wiggly fell to 82 by the time the exchange's closing bell ended the chaotic session. The rumor proved to be true. After the close of business, the governing committee of the exchange announced both the suspension of trading in Piggly Wiggly and the extension of the short seller's delivery deadline until further action by this committee. There was no immediate official reason given for this decision, but some members of the committee unofficially let it be known that they had been afraid of a repetition of the Northern Pacific Panic if the corner were not broken. On the other hand, irreverent sideliners were inclined to wonder whether the governing committee had not been moved by the pitiful plight of the cornered short sellers, many of whom, as in the Stutz motor case 2 years earlier, were believed to be members of the exchange. Despite all this, Saunders, in Memphis, was in a jubilant, expansive mood that Tuesday evening. After all, his paper profits at that moment ran to several million dollars. The hitch, of course, was that he could not realize them. But he seems to have been slow to grasp that fact or to understand the extent to which his position had been undermined. The indications are that he went to bed convinced that, besides having personally brought about a first-class mess on the hated stock exchange, he had made himself a bundle and had demonstrated how a poor southern boy could teach the city slickers a lesson. It all must have added up to a heady sensation. But, like most such sensations, it didn't last long. By Wednesday evening, when Saunders issued his first public utterance on the Pigley crisis, his mood had changed to an odd mixture of puzzlement, defiance, and a somewhat muted echo of the crowing triumph of the night before. A razor to my throat, figuratively speaking, is why I suddenly and without warning kicked the pegs from under Wall Street and its gang of gamblers and market manipulators, he declared in a press interview. It was strictly a question of whether I should survive, and likewise my business and the fortunes of my friends, or whether I should be licked and pointed to as a boob from Tennessee. And the consequence was that the boastful and supposedly invulnerable Wall Street powers found their methods controverted by well-laid plans and quick action. Saunders wound up his statement by laying down his terms. The stock exchange's deadline extension notwithstanding, he would expect settlement in full on all short stock by 3 p.m. the next day, Thursday, at $150 a share. Thereafter, his price would be $250. On Thursday, to Saunders' surprise, very few short sellers came forward to settle. Presumably, those who did couldn't stand the uncertainty. But then the governing committee kicked the pegs from under Saunders by announcing that the stock of Piggly Wiggly was permanently stricken from its trading list, and that the short sellers would be given a full 5 days from the original deadline, that is, until 2:15 the following Monday, to meet their obligations. In Memphis, Saunders, far removed from the scene though he was, could not miss the import of these moves. He was now on the losing end of things. Nor could he any longer fail to see that the postponement of the short seller's deadline was the vital issue. As I understand it, he said in another statement handed to reporters that evening, the failure of a broker to meet his clearings through the stock exchange at the appointed time is the same as a bank that would be unable to meet its clearings, and all of us know what would happen to that kind of a bank. The bank examiner would have a sign stuck up on the door with the word closed. It is unbelievable to me that the august and all-powerful New York Stock Exchange is a welcher. Therefore, I continue to believe that the shares of stock still due me on contracts will be settled on the proper basis. An editorial in the Memphis Commercial Appeal backed up Saunders' cry of treachery, declaring, "This looks like what gamblers call welching. We hope the homeboy beats them to a frazzle." That same Thursday, by coincidence, the annual financial report of Piggly Wiggly Stores Incorporated was made public. It was a highly favorable one. Sales, profits, current assets, and all other significant figures were up sharply over the year before. But nobody paid any attention to it. For the moment, the real worth of the company was irrelevant. The point was the game. On Friday morning, the Piggly Wiggly bubble burst. It burst because Saunders, who had said his price would rise to $250 a share after 3 p.m. Thursday, made the startling announcement that he would settle for $100. E.W. Bradford, Saunders' New York lawyer, was asked why Saunders had suddenly granted this striking concession. Saunders had done it out of the generosity of his heart, Bradford replied gamely. But the truth was soon obvious. Saunders had made the concession because he'd had to. The postponement granted by the stock exchange had given the short sellers and their brokers a chance to scan lists of Piggly Wiggly stockholders, and from these they'd been able to smoke out small blocks of shares that Saunders had not cornered. Widows and orphans in Albuquerque and Sioux City, who knew nothing about short sellers and corners, were only too happy, when pressed, to dig into their mattresses or safe deposit boxes and sell, in the so-called over-the-counter market, since the stock could no longer be traded on the exchange, their 10 or 20 shares of Piggly Wiggly for at least double what they had paid for them. Consequently, instead of having to buy stock from Saunders at his price of $250 and then hand it back to him in settlement of their loans, many of the short sellers were able to buy it in over-the-counter trading at around $100, and thus, with bitter pleasure, pay off their Memphis adversary, not in cash, but in shares of Piggly Wiggly, the very last thing he wanted just then. By nightfall Friday, virtually all the short sellers were in the clear, having redeemed their indebtedness either by these over-the-counter purchases or by paying Saunders cash at his own suddenly deflated rate of $100 a share. That evening, Saunders released still another statement, and this one, while still defiant, was unmistakably a howl of anguish. "Wall Street got licked and then called for Mama," it read. "Of all the institutions in America, the New York Stock Exchange is the worst menace of all in its power to ruin all who dare to oppose it. A law unto itself, an association of men who claim the right that no king or autocrat ever dared to take. To make a rule that applies one day on contracts and abrogate it the next day to let out a bunch of welchers. My whole life, from this day on, will be aimed toward the end of having the public protected from a like occurrence. I am not afraid. Let Wall Street get me if they can." But it appeared that Wall Street had got him. His corner was broken, leaving him deeply in debt to the syndicate of Southern bankers and encumbered with a mountain of stock whose immediate future was, to say the least, precarious. Saunders' fulminations did not go unheeded on Wall Street, and as a result, the exchange felt compelled to justify itself. On Monday, March 26th, shortly after the Piggly Wiggly short seller's deadline had passed and Saunders' corner was, for all practical purposes, a dead issue, the exchange offered its apologia in the form of a lengthy review of the crisis from beginning to end. In presenting its case, the exchange emphasized the public harm that might have been done if the corner had gone unbroken, explaining, "The enforcement, simultaneously, of all contracts for the return of the stock would have forced the stock to any price that might be fixed by Mr. Saunders, and competitive bidding for the insufficient supply might have brought about conditions illustrated by other corners, notably the Northern Pacific corner in 1901. Then, its syntax yielding to its sincerity, the exchange went on to say that the demoralizing effects of such a situation are not limited to those directly affected by the contracts, but extends to the whole market. Getting down to the two specific actions it had taken, the suspension of trading in Piggly Wiggly and the extension of the short seller's deadline, the exchange argued that both of them were within the bounds of its own constitution and rules, and therefore irreproachable. Arrogant as this may sound now, the exchange had a point. In those days, its rules were just about the only controls over stock trading. The question of whether, even by their own rules, the slickers really played fair with the boob is still debated among fiscal antiquarians. There is strong presumptive evidence that the slickers themselves later came to have their doubts. Regarding the right of the exchange to suspend trading in a stock, there can be no argument, since the right was, as the exchange claimed at the time, specifically granted in its constitution. But the right to postpone the deadline for short sellers to honor their contracts, though also claimed at the time, is another matter. In June 1925, 2 years after Saunders' corner, the exchange felt constrained to amend its constitution, with an article stating that, "Whenever, in the opinion of the governing committee, a corner has been created in a security listed on the exchange, the governing committee may postpone the time for deliveries on exchange contracts therein." by adopting a statute authorizing it to do what it had done long before, the exchange would seem, at the very least, to have exposed a guilty conscience. The immediate aftermath of the Pigley crisis was a wave of sympathy for Saunders. Throughout the hinterland, the public image of him became that of a gallant champion of the underdog, who had been ruthlessly crushed. Even in New York, the very lair of the stock exchange, the Times conceded, in an editorial, that in the minds of many people, Saunders represented St. George, and the stock exchange, the Dragon. That the Dragon triumphed in the end, said the Times, was bad news for a nation at least 66 2/3% sucker, which had its moment of triumph when it read that a sucker had trimmed the interests and had his foot on Wall Street's neck, while the vicious manipulators gasped their lives away. Not a man to ignore such a host of friendly fellow suckers, Saunders went to work to turn them to account. And he needed them, for his position was perilous indeed. His biggest problem was what to do about the $10 million that he owed his banker backers and didn't have. The basic plan behind his corner, if he had had any plan at all, must have been to make such a killing that he could pay back a big slice of his debt out of the profits, pay back the rest out of the proceeds from his public stock sale, and then walk off with a still huge block of Piggly Wiggly stock, free and clear. Even though the cut-rate $100 settlement had netted him a killing by most men's standards, just how much of a killing is not known, but it has been reliably estimated at 500,000 or so, it was not a fraction of what he might have reasonably expected it to be, and because it wasn't, his whole structure became an arch without a keystone. Having paid his bankers what he had received from the short sellers and from his public stock sale, Saunders found that he still owed them about $5 million, half of it due September 1, 1923, and the balance on January 1, 1924. His best hope of raising the money lay in selling more of the vast bundle of Piggly Wiggly shares he still had on hand. Since he could no longer sell them on the exchange, he resorted to his favorite form of self-expression, newspaper advertising, this time supplemented with a mail-order pitch offering Piggly Wiggly again at $55. It soon became evident, though, that public sympathy was one thing, and public willingness to translate sympathy into cash was quite another. Everyone, whether in New York, Memphis, or Texarkana, knew about the recent speculative shenanigans in Piggly Wiggly and about the dubious state that the president's finances. Not even Saunders' fellow suckers would have any part of his deal now, and the campaign was a bleak failure. Sadly accepting this fact, Saunders next appealed to the local and regional pride of his Memphis neighbors by turning his remarkable powers of persuasion to the job of convincing them that his financial dilemma was a civic issue. If he should go broke, he argued, it would reflect not only on the character and business acumen of Memphis, but on Southern honor in general. "I do not ask for charity," he wrote in one of the large ads he always seemed able to find the cash for, "and I do not request any flowers for my financial funeral. But I do ask everybody in Memphis to recognize and know that this is a serious statement made for the purpose of acquainting those who wish to assist in this matter, that they may work with me and with other friends and believers in my business in a Memphis campaign to have every man and woman who possibly can in this city become one of the partners of the Piggly Wiggly business, because it is a good investment first, and second, because it is the right thing to do." Raising his sights in a second ad, he declared, "For Piggly Wiggly to be ruined would shame the whole South." Just which argument proved the clincher in persuading Memphis that it should try to pull Saunders' chestnuts out of the fire is hard to say, but some part of his line of reasoning clicked, and soon the Memphis commercial appeal was urging the town to get behind the embattled local boy. The response of the city's business leaders was truly inspiring to Saunders. A whirlwind 3-day campaign was planned, with the object of selling 50,000 shares of his stock to the citizens of Memphis at the old magic figure of $55 a share, in order to give buyers some degree of assurance that they would not later find themselves alone out on a limb. It was stipulated that unless the whole block was sold within the 3 days, all sales would be called off. The Chamber of Commerce sponsored the drive. The American Legion, the Civitan Club, and the Exchange Club fell into line, and even the Bowers stores and the Aero stores, both competitors of Piggly Wiggly in Memphis, agreed to plug the worthy cause. Hundreds of civic-minded volunteers signed up to ring doorbells. On May 3rd, 5 days before the scheduled start of the campaign, 250 Memphis businessmen assembled at the Gayoso Hotel for a kickoff dinner. There were cheers when Saunders, accompanied by his wife, entered the dining room. One of the many after-dinner speakers described him as the man who has done more for Memphis than any in the last 1,000 years. A rousing tribute that put God knew how many Chickasaw chiefs in their place. Business rivalries and personal differences were swept away like mists before the sun, a Commercial Appeal reporter wrote of the dinner. The drive got off to a splendid start. On the opening day, May 8th, society women and Boy Scouts paraded the streets of Memphis wearing badges that read, "We're 100% for Clarence Saunders and Piggly Wiggly." Merchants adorned their windows with placards bearing the slogan, "A share of Piggly Wiggly stock in every home." Telephones and doorbells rang incessantly. In short order, 23,698 of the 50,000 shares had been subscribed for. Yet, at the very moment when most of Memphis had become miraculously convinced that the peddling of Piggly Wiggly stock was an activity fully as uplifting as soliciting for the Red Cross or the community chest, ugly doubts were brewing, and some vipers in the home nest suddenly demanded that Saunders consent to an immediate spot audit of his company's books. Saunders, for whatever reasons, refused, but offered to placate the skeptics by stepping down as president of Piggly Wiggly if such a move would facilitate the stock-selling campaign. He was not asked to give up the presidency, but on May 9th, the second day of the campaign, a watchdog committee of 4, 3 bankers and a businessman, was appointed by the Piggly Wiggly directors to help him run the company for an interim period, while the dust settled. That same day, Saunders was confronted with another embarrassing situation. Why, the campaign leaders wanted to know, was he continuing to build his million-dollar pink palace at a time when the whole town was working for him for nothing? He replied hastily that he would have the place boarded up the very next day, and that there would be no further construction until his financial future looked bright again. The confusion attendant on these two issues brought the drive to a standstill. At the end of the third day, the total number of shares subscribed for was still under 25,000, and the sales that had been made were canceled. Saunders had to admit that the drive had been a failure. "Memphis has fizzled," he reportedly added, although he was at great pains to deny this a few years later, when he needed more of Memphis's money for a new venture. It would not be surprising, though, if he had made some such imprudent remark, for he was understandably suffering from a case of frazzled nerves, and was showing the strain. Just before the announcement of the campaign's unhappy end, he went into a closed conference with several Memphis business leaders and came out of it with a bruised cheekbone and a torn collar. None of the other men at the meeting showed any marks of violence. It just wasn't Saunders' day. Although it was never established that Saunders had had his hand improperly in the Piggly Wiggly corporate till during his cornering operation, his first business move, after the collapse of his attempt to unload stock, suggested that he had at least had good reason to refuse a spot audit of the company's books. In spite of futile grunts of protest from the watchdog committee, he began selling not Piggly Wiggly stock, but Piggly Wiggly stores, partly liquidating the company, that is, and no one knew where he would stop. The Chicago stores went first, and those in Denver and Kansas City soon followed. His announced intention was to build up the company's treasury so that it could buy the stock that the public had spurned. But there was some suspicion that the treasury desperately needed a transfusion just then, and not of Piggly Wiggly stock either. "I've got Wall Street and the whole gang licked," Saunders reported cheerfully in June. But in mid-August, with the September 1st deadline for repayment of $2.5 million on his loan staring him in the face, and with nothing like that amount of cash either on hand or in prospect, he resigned as president of Piggly Wiggly Stores Incorporated and turned over his assets, his stock in the company, his pink palace, and all the rest of his property to his creditors. It remained only for the formal stamp of failure to be put on Saunders personally and on Piggly Wiggly under his management. On August 22nd, the New York auction firm of Adrian H. Muller & Son, which dealt in so many next-to-worthless stocks that its salesroom was often called the Securities Graveyard, knocked down 1,500 shares of Piggly Wiggly at $1 a share, the traditional price for securities that had been run into the ground. And the following spring, Saunders went through formal bankruptcy proceedings. But these were anticlimaxes. The real low point of Saunders' career was probably the day he was forced out of his company's presidency. And it was then that, in the opinion of many of his admirers, he achieved his rhetorical peak. When he emerged, harassed but still defiant, from a director's conference and announced his resignation to reporters, a hush fell. Then Saunders added hoarsely, "They have the body of Piggly Wiggly, but they cannot have the soul." If by the soul of Piggly Wiggly, Saunders meant himself, then it did remain free. Free to go marching on in its own erratic way. He never ventured to play another game of corner, but his spirit was far from broken. Although officially bankrupt, he managed to find people of truly rock-like faith who were still willing to finance him, and they enabled him to live on a scale only slightly less grand than in the past, reduced to playing golf at the Memphis Country Club rather than on his own private course. He handed out caddy tips that the club governors considered as corrupting as ever. To be sure, he no longer owned the Pink Palace, but this was about the only evidence that served to remind his fellow townsmen of his misfortunes. Eventually, the unfinished Pleasure Dome came into the hands of the city of Memphis, which appropriated $150,000 to finish it and turn it into a museum of natural history and industrial arts. As such, it continues to sustain the Saunders legend in Memphis. After his downfall, Saunders spent the better part of 3 years in seeking redress of the wrongs that he felt he had suffered in the Piggly Wiggly fight, and in foiling the efforts of his enemies and creditors to make things still more unpleasant for him. For a while, he kept threatening to sue the stock exchange for conspiracy and breach of contract, but a test suit brought by some small Piggly Wiggly stockholders failed, and he dropped the idea. Then, in January 1926, he learned that a federal indictment was about to be brought against him for using the mails to defraud in his mail-order campaign to sell his Piggly Wiggly stock. He believed, incorrectly, that the government had been egged on to bring the indictment by an old associate of his, John C. Birch of Memphis, who had become secretary-treasurer of Piggly Wiggly after the shakeup. His patience once more exhausted, Saunders went around to Piggly Wiggly headquarters and confronted Birch. This conference proved far more satisfactory to Saunders than his boardroom scuffle on the day the Memphis Civic stock-selling drive failed. Birch, according to Saunders, undertook in a stammering way to deny the accusation, whereupon Saunders delivered a right to the jaw, knocking off Birch's glasses, but not doing much other damage. Birch afterward belittled the blow as glancing, and added an alibi that sounded like that of any outpointed pugilist. The assault upon me was made so suddenly that I did not have time or opportunity to strike Mr. Saunders. Birch refused to press charges. About a month later, the mail fraud indictment was brought against Saunders, but by that time, satisfied that Birch was innocent of any dirty work, he was his amiable old self again. "I have only one thing to regret in this new affair," he announced pleasantly, "and that is my fistic encounter with John C. Birch." The new affair didn't last long. In April, the indictment was quashed by the Memphis District Court, and Saunders and Piggly Wiggly were finally quits. By then, the company was well on its way back up, and with a greatly changed corporate structure, it flourished on into the 1960s. Housewives continued to ramble down the aisles of hundreds of Piggly Wiggly stores, now operated under franchise agreement with the Piggly Wiggly Corporation of Jacksonville, Florida. Saunders, too, was well on his way back up. In 1928, he started a new grocery chain, which he, but hardly anyone else, called the Clarence Saunders, sole owner of My Name Stores, Incorporated. Its outlets soon came to be known as Sole Owner Stores, which was precisely what they weren't, for without Saunders' faithful backers, they would have existed only in his mind. Saunders' choice of a corporate title, however, was not designed to mislead the public. Rather, it was his ironic way of reminding the world that, after the skinning Wall Street had given him, his name was about the only thing he still had a clear title to. How many sole owner customers, or governors of the stock exchange for that matter, got the point is questionable. In any case, the new stores caught on so rapidly and did so well that Saunders leaped back up from bankruptcy to riches and bought a $1 million estate just outside Memphis. He also organized and underwrote a professional football team called the Sole Owner Tigers, an investment that paid off handsomely on the fall afternoons when he could hear cries of "Rah, rah, rah, sole owner, sole owner, sole owner," ringing through the Memphis stadium. For the second time, Saunders' glory was fleeting. The very first wave of the Depression hit sole owner stores such a crushing blow that in 1930 they went bankrupt, and he was broke again. But again he pulled himself together and survived the debacle. Finding backers, he planned a new chain of grocery stores and thought up a name for it that was more outlandish, if possible, than either of its predecessors. Kidoozle. He never made another killing, however, or bought another $1 million estate, though it was always clear that he expected to. His hopes were pinned on the Kidoozle, an electrically operated grocery store, and he spent the better part of the last 20 years of his life trying to perfect it. In a Kidoozle store, the merchandise was displayed behind glass panels, each with a slot beside it, like the food in an automat. There the similarity ended, for instead of inserting coins in the slot to open a panel and lift out a purchase, Kidoozle customers inserted a key that they were given on entering the store. Moreover, Saunders' thinking had advanced far beyond the elementary stage of having the key open the panel. Each time a Kidoozle key was inserted in a slot, the identity of the item selected was inscribed in code on a segment of recording tape embedded in the key itself, and simultaneously the item was automatically transferred to a conveyor belt that carried it to an exit gate at the front of the store. When a customer had finished his shopping, he would present his key to an attendant at the gate who would decipher the tape and add up the bill. As soon as this was paid, the purchases would be catapulted into the customer's arms, all bagged and wrapped, by a device at the end of the conveyor belt. A couple of pilot Kidoozle stores were tried out, one in Memphis and another in Chicago, but it was found that the machinery was too complex and expensive to compete with supermarket pushcarts. Undeterred, Saunders set to work on an even more intricate mechanism. The food electric, which would do everything the caduzel could do and add up the bill as well. It will never corner the retail store equipment market, though, because it was still unfinished when Saunders died in October 1953, 5 years too soon for him to see the Bruce corner, which, in any case, he would have been fully entitled to scoff at as a mere squabble among ribbon clerks. Chapter 9. A Second Sort of Life. During Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency, when Wall Street and Washington tended to be on cat-and-dog terms, perhaps no New Dealer, other than that man himself, better typified the New Deal in the eyes of Wall Street than David Eli Lilienthal. The explanation of this estimate of him in southern Manhattan lay not in any specific anti-Wall Street acts of Lilienthal's. Indeed, the scattering of financiers, among them Wendell L. Willkie, who had personal dealings with him, generally found him to be a reasonable sort of fellow. But in what he had come to symbolize through his association with the Tennessee Valley Authority, which, as a government-owned electric power concern far larger than any private power corporation in the country, embodied Wall Street's notion of galloping socialism. Because Lilienthal was a conspicuous and vigorous member of the TVA's three-man board of directors from 1933 until 1941, and was its chairman from 1941 until 1946, the business community of that period, in his phrase, thought he wore horns. In 1946, he became the first chairman of the United States Atomic Energy Commission, and when he gave up that position, in February 1950, at the age of 50, the Times said in a news story that he had been perhaps the most controversial figure in Washington since the end of the war. What has Lilienthal been up to in the years since he left the government? As a matter of public record, he has been up to a number of things, all of them surprisingly centered on Wall Street, or on private business, or both. For one thing, Lilienthal is listed in any number of business compendiums as the co-founder and the chairman of the board of the Development and Resources Corporation. Several years ago, I phoned D&R's offices, then at 50 Broadway, New York City, and discovered it to be a private firm, Wall Street-backed as well as, give or take a block, Wall Street-based, that provides managerial, technical, business, and planning services toward the development of natural resources abroad. That is to say, D&R, whose other co-founder, the late Gordon R. Clapp, was Lilienthal's successor as TVA chairman, is in the business of helping governments set up programs more or less similar to the TVA. Since its formation in 1955, I learned, D&R had, at moderate but gratifying profit to itself, planned and managed the beginnings of a vast scheme for the reclamation of Khuzestan, an arid and poverty-stricken, though oil-rich region of western Iran, advised the government of Italy on the development of its backward southern provinces, helped the Republic of Colombia set up a TVA-like authority for its potentially fertile but flood-plagued Cauca Valley, and offered advice to Ghana on water supply, to the Ivory Coast on mineral development, and to Puerto Rico on electric power and atomic energy. For another thing, and when I found out about this, it struck me as considerably more astonishing, on form than D&R, Lilienthal has made an authentic fortune as a corporate officer and entrepreneur. In a proxy statement of the Minerals and Chemicals Corporation of America, dated June 24, 1960, that fell into my hands, I found Lilienthal listed as a director of the firm and the holder of 41,366 shares of its common stock. These shares, at the time of my investigation, were being traded on the New York Stock Exchange at something over $25 each, and simple multiplication revealed that they represented a thumping sum by most men's standards, certainly including those of a man who had spent most of his life on government wages, without the help of private resources. And for still another thing, in 1953, Harper and Brothers brought out Lilienthal's third book, Big Business, A New Era. His previous books were TVA, Democracy on the March, and This I Do Believe, which appeared in 1944 and 1949, respectively. In Big Business, Lilienthal argues that not only the productive and distributive superiority of the United States, but also its national security depends on industrial bigness, that we now have adequate public safeguards against abuses of big business, or know well enough how to fashion them as required, that big business does not tend to destroy small business, as is often supposed, but rather tends to promote it, and finally, that a big business society does not suppress individualism, as most intellectuals believe, but actually tends to encourage it by reducing poverty, disease, and physical insecurity, and increasing the opportunities for leisure and travel. Fighting words, in short, from an old New Dealer. Lilienthal is a man whose government career I, as a newspaper reader, had followed fairly closely. My interest in him as a government official had reached its peak in February 1947, when, in answer to a fierce attack on him by his old enemy, Senator Kenneth D. McKellar of Tennessee, during congressional hearings on his fitness for the AEC job, he uttered a spontaneous statement of personal Democratic faith that for many people still ranks as one of the most stirring attacks on what later came to be known as McCarthyism. One of the tenets of democracy that grow out of the central core of a belief that the individual comes first, that all men are the children of God, and their personalities are therefore sacred, Lilienthal said, among other things, is a deep belief in civil liberties and their protection, and a repugnance to anyone who would steal from a human being that which is most precious to him, his good name, by imputing things to him by innuendo or by insinuation. The fragments of information I picked up about his new private career left me confused, wondering how Wall Street and business life had affected Lilienthal and vice versa in their belated rapprochement. I got in touch with him, and a day or so later, at his invitation, drove out to New Jersey to spend the afternoon with him. Lilienthal and his wife Helen Lamb Lilienthal lived on Battle Road in Princeton, where they had settled in 1957, after 6 years in New York City, at first in a house on Beekman Place, and later in an apartment on Sutton Place. The Princeton house, which stands in a plot of less than an acre, is of Georgian brick with green shutters. Surrounded by other houses of its kind, the place is capacious yet anything but pretentious. Lilienthal, wearing gray slacks and a plaid sports shirt, met me at the front door. At just past 60, he was a tall, trim man with a receding hairline, a slightly hawk-like profile, and candid, piercing eyes. He led me into the living room, where he introduced Mrs. Lilienthal, and then pointed out a couple of household treasures. A large oriental rug in front of the fireplace, which he said was a gift from the Shah of Iran, and, hanging on the wall opposite the fireplace, a Chinese scroll of the late 19th century, showing four rather roguish men, who he told me have a special meaning for him, since they are upper, middle-rank civil servants. Pointing to a particularly enigmatic-looking fellow, he added, with a smile, that he always thought of that one as his Oriental counterpart. Mrs. Lilienthal went to get coffee, and while she was gone, I asked Lilienthal to tell me something of his post-government life, starting at the beginning. "All right," he said, "the beginning. I left the AEC for a number of reasons. In that kind of work, I feel, a fellow is highly expendable. If you stayed too long, you might find yourself placating industry, or the military, or both, building up what would amount to an atomic pork barrel. Another thing, I wanted to be allowed to speak my mind more freely than I could as a government official. I felt I'd served my term, so I turned in my resignation in November 1949, and it went into effect 3 months later. As for the timing, I resigned then because, for once, I wasn't under fire. Originally, I'd planned to do it earlier in 1949, but then came the last congressional attack on me. The time Hickenlooper of Iowa accused me of incredible mismanagement. I noticed that Lilienthal did not smile in referring to the Hickenlooper affair. "I entered private life with both trepidation and relief," he went on. "The trepidation was about my ability to make a living, and it was very real. Oh, I'd been a practicing lawyer as a young man in Chicago before going into government work, and made quite a lot of money at it, too. But now I didn't want to practice law, and I was worried about what else I could do. I was so obsessed with the subject that I harped on it all the time, and my wife and my friends began to kid me. That Christmas of 1949, my wife gave me a beggar's tin cup, and one of my friends gave me a guitar to go with it. The feeling of relief, well, that was a matter of personal privacy and freedom. As a private citizen, I wouldn't have to be trailed around by hordes of security officers as I had been at the AEC. I wouldn't have to answer the charges of congressional committees. And above all, I'd be able to talk freely to my wife again. Mrs. Lilienthal had returned with the coffee as her husband was talking, and now she sat down with us. She comes, I knew, from a family of pioneers who, over several generations, moved westward from New England to Ohio to Indiana to Oklahoma, where she was born. She seemed to me to look the part, that of a woman of dignity, patience, practicality, and gentle strength. "I can tell you that my husband's resignation was a relief to me," she said. "Before he went with the AEC, we'd always talked over all aspects of his work. When he took that job, we agreed between us that although we'd indulge in the discussion of personalities as freely as we pleased, he would never tell me anything about the work of the AEC that I couldn't read in the newspapers. It was a terrible constraint to be under." Lilienthal nodded. "I'd come home at night with some frightful experience in me," he said. "No one who so much as touches the atom is ever quite the same again. Perhaps I'd have been in a series of conferences and listened to the kind of talk that many military and scientific men go in for. Cities full of human beings referred to as targets, and that sort of thing. I never got used to that impersonal jargon. I'd come home sick at heart. But I couldn't talk about it to Helen. I wasn't allowed to get it off my chest." "And now there wouldn't be any more hearings," Mrs. Lilienthal said. "Those terrible hearings. I'll never forget one Washington cocktail party we went to for our sins. My husband had been going through one of the endless series of congressional hearings. A woman in a funny hat came gushing up to him and said something like, 'Oh, Mr. Lilienthal, I was so anxious to come to your hearings, but I just couldn't make it. I'm so sorry. I just love hearings, don't you?'" Husband and wife looked at each other, and this time, Lilienthal managed a grin. Lilienthal seemed glad to get on to what happened next. At about the time his resignation became effective, he told me, he was approached by various men from Harvard, representing the fields of history, public administration, and law, who asked him to accept an appointment to the faculty. But he decided he didn't want to become a professor any more than he wanted to practice law. Within the next few weeks came offers from numerous law firms in New York and Washington, and from some industrial companies. Reassured by these that he was not going to need the tin cup and guitar after all, Lilienthal, after mulling over the offers, finally turned them all down and settled, in May 1950, for a part-time job as a consultant to the celebrated banking firm of Lazard Frere and Company, whose senior partner, Andre Meyer, he had met through Albert Lasker, a mutual friend. Lazard gave him an office in its headquarters at 44 Wall. but before he could do much consulting, he was off on a lecture tour across the United States, followed by a trip to Europe that summer with his wife, on behalf of the late Collier's magazine. The trip did not result in any articles, though, and on returning home in the fall, he found it necessary to get back on a full-time income-producing basis. This he did by becoming a consultant to various other companies, among them the Carrier Corporation and the Radio Corporation of America. To Carrier, he offered advice on managerial problems. For RCA, he worked on the question of color television, ultimately advising his client to concentrate on technical research rather than on law court squabbles over patents. He also helped persuade the company to press its computer program and to stay out of the construction of atomic reactors. Early in 1951, he took another trip abroad for Collier's, to India, Pakistan, Thailand, and Japan. This trip produced an article, published in Collier's that August, in which he proposed a solution to the dispute between India and Pakistan over Kashmir and the headwaters of the Indus River. Lilienthal's idea was that the tension between the two countries could best be lessened by a cooperative program to improve living conditions in the whole disputed area through economic development of the Indus Basin. 9 years later, largely through the financial backing and moral support of Eugene R. Black and the World Bank, the Lilienthal Plan was essentially adopted, and an Indus Treaty signed between India and Pakistan. But the immediate reaction to his article was general indifference, and Lilienthal, temporarily stymied and considerably disillusioned, once more settled down to the humbler problems of private business. At this point in Lilienthal's narrative, the doorbell rang. Mrs. Lilienthal went to answer it, and I could hear her talking to someone, a gardener evidently, about the pruning of some roses. After listening restlessly for a minute or two, Lilienthal called to his wife. "Helen, please tell Dominic to prune those roses farther back than he did last year." Mrs. Lilienthal went outside with Dominic, and Lilienthal remarked, "Dominic always prunes too gently, to my way of thinking. It's a case of our backgrounds, Italy versus the Middle West." Then, resuming where he had left off, he said that his association with Lazard Frere, and more particularly with Meyer, had led him into an association, first as a consultant and later as an executive, with a small company called the Minerals Separation North American Corporation, in which Lazard Frere had a large interest. It was in this undertaking that, unexpectedly, he made his fortune. The company was in trouble, and Meyer's notion was that Lilienthal might be the man to do something about it. Subsequently, in the course of a series of mergers, acquisitions, and other maneuvers, the company's name was changed to, successively, the Adipolgus Minerals and Chemicals Corporation, the Minerals and Chemicals Corporation of America, and in 1960, the Minerals and Chemicals Philip Corporation. Meanwhile, its annual receipts rose from about $750,000 for 1952 to something over $274 million for 1960. For Lilienthal, the acceptance of Meyer's commission to look into the company's affairs was the beginning of a four-year immersion in the day-to-day problems of managing a business. The experience, he said decisively, turned out to be one of his life's richest, and by no means only in the literal sense of that word. I have reconstructed the corporate facts behind Lilienthal's experience, partly from what he told me in Princeton, partly from a subsequent study of some of the company's published documents, and partly from talks with other persons interested in the firm. Minerals Separation North American, which was founded in 1916 as an offshoot of a British firm, was a patent company, deriving its chief income from royalties on patents for processes used in refining copper ore and the ores of other non-ferrous minerals. Its activities were twofold: attempting to develop new patents in its research laboratory, and offering technical services to the mining and manufacturing companies that leased its old ones. By 1950, although it was still netting a nice annual profit, it was in a bad way. Under the direction of its longtime president, Dr. Seth Gregory, who was then over 90 but still ruled the company with an iron hand, commuting daily between his Midtown apartment hotel and his office at 11 Broadway in a regally purple Rolls Royce, it had cut down its research activities to almost nothing and was living on half a dozen old patents, all of which were scheduled to go into the public domain in from 5 to 8 years. In effect, it was a still healthy company living under a death sentence. Lizard Frere, as a large stockholder, was understandably concerned. Dr. Gregory was persuaded to retire on a handsome pension, and in February 1952, after working with mineral separation for some time as a consultant, Lilienthal was installed as the company's president and a member of its board of directors. His first task was to find a new source of income to replace the fast-expiring patents, and he and the other directors agreed that the way to accomplish this was through a merger. It fell to Lilienthal to participate in arranging one between Minerals Separation and another company in which Lizard Frere, along with the Wall Street firm of F. Eberstadt and Company, had large holdings, the Adipolgus Clay Company of Adipolgus, Georgia, which produced a very rare kind of clay that is useful in purifying petroleum products, and which manufactured various household products, among them a floor cleaner called Speedy Dry. As a marriage broker between Mineral Separation and Adipolgus, Lilienthal had the touchy job of persuading the executives of the Southern Company that they were not being used as pawns by a bunch of rapacious Wall Street bankers. Being an agent of the bankers was an unaccustomed role for Lilienthal, but he evidently carried it off with aplomb, despite the fact that his presence complicated the emotional problems still further by introducing into the situation a whiff of galloping socialism. Dave was very effective in building up the Adipolgus people's morale and confidence, another Wall Streeter has told me. He reconciled them to the merger and showed them its advantages for them. Lilienthal himself told me, "I felt at home in the administrative and technical parts of the job, but the financial part had to be done by the people from Lazard and Eberstadt. Every time they began talking about spin-offs and exchanges of shares, I was lost. I didn't even know what a spin-off was." As Lilienthal knows now, it is, not to get too technical about it, a division of a company into two or more companies, the opposite of a merger. The merger took place in December 1952, and neither the Adipolgus people nor the Minerals Separation people had any reason to regret it, because both the profits and the stock price of the newly formed company, the Adipolgus Minerals and Chemicals Corporation, soon began to rise. At the time of the merger, Lilienthal was made chairman of the board of directors, at an annual salary of $18,000. Over the next 3 years, while serving first in this position and later as chairman of the executive committee, he had a large part not only in the conduct of the company's routine affairs, but also in its further growth through a series of new mergers, one in 1954 with Edgar Brothers, a leading producer of kaolin for paper coating, and two in 1955, with a pair of limestone concerns in Ohio and Virginia. The mergers and the increased efficiency that went with them were not long in paying off. Between 1952 and 1955, the company's net profit per share more than quintupled. The mechanics of Lilienthal's own rise, from the comparative rags of a public servant to the riches of a successful entrepreneur, are baldly outlined in the company's proxy statements for its annual and special stockholders' meetings. There are few public documents more indiscreet than proxy statements in which the precise private stockholdings of directors must be listed. In November 1952, Minerals Separation North American granted Lilienthal, as a supplement to his annual salary, a stock option. His option entitled him to buy as many as 50,000 shares of the firm's stock from its treasury at $4.87.5 per share, then the going rate, any time before the end of 1955. And in exchange, he signed a contract agreeing to serve the company as an active executive throughout 1953, 1954, and 1955. The potential financial advantage to him, of course, as to all other recipients of stock options, lay in the fact that if the price of the stock rose substantially, he could buy shares at the option price, and thus have a holding that would immediately be worth much more than he paid for it. Furthermore, and more important, if he should later decide to sell his shares, the proceeds would be a capital gain, taxable at a maximum rate of 25%. Of course, if the stock failed to go up, the option would be worthless. But like so many stocks of the mid-50s, Lilienthal's did go up, fantastically. By the end of 1954, according to the proxy statements, Lilienthal had exercised his option to the extent of buying 12,750 shares, which were then worth not $4.87.5 each, but about $20. In February 1955, he sold off 4,000 shares at $22.75 each, bringing in $91,000. This sum, less capital gains tax, was then applied against further purchases under the option. And in August 1955, the proxy statements show Lilienthal raised his holdings to almost 40,000 shares, or close to the number he held at the time of my visit to him. By that time, the stock, which had at first been sold over the counter, not only had achieved a listing on the New York Stock Exchange, but had become one of the exchange's high-flying speculative favorites. Its price had skyrocketed to about $40 a share, and Lilienthal, obviously, was solidly in the millionaire class. Moreover, the company was now on a sound long-term basis, paying an annual cash dividend of 50 cents a share, and the Lilienthal family's financial worries were permanently over. Fiscally speaking, Lilienthal told me, his symbolic moment of triumph was the day, in June of 1955, when the shares of Minerals and Chemicals graduated to a listing on the New York Stock Exchange. In accordance with custom, Lilienthal, as a top officer, was invited onto the floor to shake hands with the president of the exchange.